Hey, everybody. It is Thursday, March 21st. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast. I'm Moshe Wanunu. And just a couple feet away from me, in real life, I think it's you, Jill.
It is. Hi, everybody. I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts. And today we are in person.
Yes. Welcome back to Brooklyn, Jill. We always like to have you here.
That's right, Moshe. One of our producers, Emily Gross, turned the ripe old age of 26 on Wednesday. So I came into Brooklyn. We did a big celebratory lunch. And now we're doing the podcast in person.
Yes, it was great to have the whole team together here, the whole Mo News team. Jill, for a jam-packed news day here.
And for the first time, I think in a long time, there's no real doom and gloom here. There's no deaths that we're reporting. It's kind of a lighter podcast.
Yes, a day late for World Happiness Day. But here you go, folks. Today's podcast brings you some news, some serious topics. But yes, no doom and gloom in today's pod.
All right, time for the headlines. Joe Biden makes another push for American cars to go electric. Boogie woogie woogie. How's that for a 90s reference? And because we're in person and there are other people in this room, there is outside laughter.
The electric slide towards EVs. Jill, I got it. We should note for the record, the song's from the 70s, but yes, it did get really big in the 90s.
It was big on the bar mitzvah circuit of the early 1990s. Happiness is a state of mind, and in the U.S., that state of mind, not great. The U.S. hit an all-time low in a ranking of the annual World Happiness Report. To politics, Donald Trump is reportedly in panic mode as he faces a deadline for a massive $500 million bond. In other Trump legal news, a Georgia judge allows Trump and his co-defendants to appeal the decision that lets Fannie Willis continue on the 2020 election case. To some hack attacks, a big warning about hackers targeting our water systems, and an update on that massive hack of United Health Group. Another country in turmoil, this time we look at Cuba as it deals with the biggest protests in years, what's behind them, a potential breakthrough in a treatment for HIV. And the most popular dog breed in America is?
We'll give you a clue. It was also the most popular dog breed last year.
And Moshe has on this day in history.
Jill, we got NSYNC, we got U2, we got Taco Bell, and Alcatraz. Jam-packed on this day in history for you.
All right, let's get to the news. The Biden administration wants to accelerate the country's transition to electric vehicles, and on Wednesday enacted the strictest ever rules for tailpipe emissions. But it's also giving automakers more time to increase EV sales. The rules could lead to electric vehicles accounting for 56% of new cars sold in 2032. So are gas guzzlers a thing of the past? Not exactly. The new rules are not an EV mandate or a ban of gas cars. Instead, the standards are for car makers' entire fleet in the years 2027 through 2032. It's an average of the overall cars produced. In theory, cars that have higher emissions would be averaged out with low or zero emission cars. The shift to EVs will impact light-duty vehicles, cars, SUVs, and most pickup trucks, and will shift the entire market to be more green. When the EPA targets were released about a year ago, which would have required 60% of new car sales be fully electric by the 2030 model year, automakers warned President Biden that consumers just wouldn't be ready for that. The EPA's updated rule slows things down a bit, so it'll be about 31 to 44% of new car sales by the model year 2030. And again, by 2032, the target is 56%.
Yeah, we're dealing with a moving target here right now. Last year did see more electric vehicle sales than any year before it. About 1.2 million cars sold last year were electric, but that still only accounts for about 8% of total U.S. car sales. So still a very ambitious goal, Jill, as we talk about the 2030s, that's not that many years away, right? We're in 2024 already. So what they're talking about here is a massive transition in less than 10 years, especially if we want to go from about 8% to 56% within 8 years here. Many in the car industry still say the standards are very aggressive here. One of the industry's top lobbying groups saying that automakers are committed to the transition to EVs, but, quote, pace matters, and the market and the supply chain will need a chance to catch up. We've talked on this podcast before about my frustration when I rented an electric car trying to find chargers. If you own a car and you have a garage, that might work for you with short distances. But there's a whole variety of areas of this country where that's a challenge. We've also talked about on this pod a cold weather situation, that because these are batteries, in the same way that your iPhone battery depletes in really cold weather, the same thing happens with car batteries. So there's still a lot that needs to be done here. Toyota, which is still the world's largest automaker and second to GM in the US in terms of sales, said they will comply with this, but quote, serious challenges still exist around affordability, charging infrastructure, and the supply chain before this mandate can be realized. And again, as you mentioned, this is not a mandate or a ban on the sale of gas cars. Automakers can still make vehicles with higher emissions, but with these goals, it just means they're going to have to produce a lot more EVs. Now, one thing they're looking at right now that they feel will make this transition easier is hybrid cars. So there's a battery, but also some gas. We've talked to a number of people in the Mo News community who like their hybrids. Sometimes they only have to fill up the tank once a month or even less frequently because of the way the battery charges. At the same time, it does alleviate battery anxiety. You know, when you're driving a car and you see it going to 60%, 40%, there's an extra level of anxiety I think you feel versus gas. As far as impact here, why they're going this direction, let's just talk about CO2 emissions. This would, according to the EPA, avoid more than 7 billion tons of CO2 emissions over the next 30 years if we can hit this standard. That's the equivalent of removing an entire year's worth of CO2 generated by the U.S. And we should note the U.S. historically has pumped the most CO2 into the atmosphere of any other country. And per capita, still we're the biggest polluter in the world when you take our population into account. The EPA claims here that this would provide $100 billion in net benefits to society and $13 billion in public health benefits thanks to improved air quality.
Moshe, as we talked about yesterday, it was International Happiness Day. And with that, some new data on the state of happiness around the world from our friends over at Gallup. The U.S. is no longer in the top 20 happiest countries in the world. According to the Gallup World Poll for the World Happiness Report 2024, Americans fell to 23rd place in happiness, down from 15th a year ago. It's the first time that's happened since the global ranking started in 2012, due in large part to a drop in happiness among younger adults. It's something we mentioned a few days ago. Gen Z overall feeling pretty bad about things. We'll have more on that a bit later. So Finland is at the top of the list, followed by number two, Denmark, then Iceland, Sweden, Israel, Netherlands, Norway, Luxembourg, Switzerland, and Australia. So what is going so well in Finland and several other of those Scandinavian countries who top the list? Researchers say there are a lot of factors like high levels of social support and healthy life expectancy. The annual survey asks respondents to rate their current lives on a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being the best possible life for them. The rankings are based on a sample of about 1,000 people in each country, so it's not exactly a huge number. Interestingly, around the globe, young people 15 to 24 report higher life satisfaction than older adults. But the gap is narrowing in Europe and quite the opposite in North America and here in the US.
Yeah, in fact, in the US, self-reported happiness has decreased in all age groups, but especially for younger adults. And this is a trend line we're seeing in a number of places. If you just ask older Americans, 16 and above, all the questions on the happiness index, America would rank 10th in the world in overall happiness, but it's the younger folks where there's concern. As they say, the kids are not all right. Americans 30 years old and younger, if you just took that group, we rank 62nd in the world in terms of well-being. And the U.S. is not alone here. Even in Norway, over 60, third in the world. Under 30, that would put Norway 20th in the world. Australia, huge difference there between young and old. Canada, older Canadians would put the country 8th in the world. Younger Canadians put them 58th in the world. So then you take the average and you see where they land. But this is across the world. We're seeing this in Singapore as well. Researchers suspect part of the decline here among younger adults reflects their spending less time interacting with actual people in person as opposed to on social media. They also blame the increasing cost of things, making a larger impact on younger people, a higher levels of loneliness, anxiety about their future, what is happening in the world. We've talked about this a lot, right? Having social media and smartphones in your pocket your entire life and the impact that has on your overall view of things. So it's social connections, a sense of purpose, finance, etc. is what they attribute this difference between older and younger here. At the same time, though, it's not all doom and gloom for younger people. Millennials and younger Americans have been increasingly charitable, according to the study here, since the pandemic, which includes things like helping a stranger or volunteering. So some signs of happiness here in the World Happiness Report. Jill, we should note, you know, again, the U.S. ranks 23 out of 143 countries polled here. That's where Afghanistan finished in 143rd. The middle group where they basically average a five, that's the Russias, the Kyrgyzstans, Ecuadors of the world. Then as we move our way up in the 20s, the U.S. is a 23. And just between the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, where Dubai and Abu Dhabi is at 22, and then Germany at 24, and then our neighbors to the south, the Mexicans, are ranked 25th overall in the happiness index.
Mosh, are you happy?
Number one, baby. We actually put up a chart on the Instagram feed on Friday, and it was fascinating because there's separate numbers taken over the last 50 years of 12th graders graduating from high school in the U.S. in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, etc. And you saw their overall optimism versus pessimism about the world. And what they discovered was peak optimism in the last 50 years are the high school classes of 2000 to 2003, with 2002 being the most optimistic high school graduating class in effectively modern American history. So as a member of the high school class of 2000, I was like, maybe it has something to do with when I graduated high school. Like, we're just wired more positively. But it was fascinating to see that, because you also saw sort of a peak in pessimism in the early 90s, sort of the Gen Xers, you know, early like Kurt Cobain, Reality Bites, you know, grunge. People get more optimistic through the late 90s, early 2000s. And then you see this basically skyrocketing pessimism starting in the mid-2000s, but really coinciding, again, we don't want to give it too much blame, but with the smartphone and with social media over the course of the past decade.
And not to belabor the point, you and I were chatting with the two 20-somethings in our office, and we were saying we feel like we're happier in our 30s and even 40s than when we were in our 20s, just because of things like job insecurity. You're not as secure socially in terms of relationships. So perhaps as people get older, even this generation of Gen Z and millennials, hopefully as they get older, they will also get happier.
Yeah, well, they're also starting from a lower number than previous generations at that age. So let's hope that. But certainly data here that policymakers, businesses, a whole variety of folks should take into consideration as we again see a lot of generational splits here in terms of political views, in terms of optimism, pessimism, and the like.
Happiness is a choice, Mosh. Remember that.
So I've heard, Jill. All right, we have a lot more news to get to in today's speed read. But first, we want to thank one of our newest sponsors, Factor Meals. If you're pressed for time in your house, you are like many households, but you still want to eat healthy. You still want to eat nutritious. So that's why we're very excited to be partnering with Factor. They are America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service. They offer dozens of meals for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat, delivered straight to your door. They are never frozen. They go straight in the fridge and then are available for a number of days. No chopping, no prepping, no cleanup, no grocery store. The meals come straight to your door and are both delicious and offer you the nutritional quality that you deserve and the one that you're looking for. They offer about three dozen weekly meals, flexible to your schedule. You can get as much or as little as you need, choosing anywhere from 6 to 18 meals a week. You can pause or reschedule the deliveries at any time. It also includes juices, shakes, smoothies. Again, 2 minutes or less, ready to go here. You can head over to factormeals.com/monews50. That is factor, F-A-C-T-O-R, meals.com/monews50. Why? Because you're going to get 50% off. So give it a try. Let us know what you think.
Okay. And now to one of our longtime sponsors, AG1. We're always talking on this podcast about health trends and food trends and how hard it is to just get all of your nutrients. Well, one way to get all of the important ones is Athletic Greens AG1 powder. I drink AG1 in the morning. It is one scoop with a glass of water. It is easy and quick. And it lets you get on with your day knowing that you've gotten over 75 important ingredients, including tons of vitamins and minerals. It also has pre and probiotics to support digestion and gut health. One of my friends likes to call it his insurance policy. It's like his nutritional insurance policy. He drinks it in the morning and then doesn't worry about what else he eats for the rest of the day, for the most part. So with your first purchase of AG1, Athletic Greens is giving Monews listeners a free one-year supply of their vitamin D and five free travel packs of AG1. Visit drinkag1.com/monews to take advantage of this offer. You can get a discounted monthly subscription or try it one time for just a month. Again, that is drinkag1.com/monews, M-O-N-E-W-S, for this special deal and really start to take ownership of your health. Okay, time now for the speed read from CNN. Former President Trump is reportedly increasingly concerned about a deadline next Monday to secure a $500 million bond. Just a few days left to find the money necessary to appeal his civil fraud case in New York. His lawyers acknowledged that he is struggling to find an insurance company willing to underwrite his $454 million bond. That bond stems from the judge's ruling last month, which ordered Trump to pay $355 million in disgorgement or ill-gotten gains. In this case, it was brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. The judge wrote in his opinion that Trump and his co-defendants, including his adult sons, were liable for fraud, conspiracy, and issuing false financial statements and false business records, finding that the defendants fraudulently inflated the value of Trump's assets to obtain more favorable loan and insurance rates. The amount Trump owed surpassed $450 million with interest included. In order to stop the state from enforcing the judgment, Trump has to post a bond to be held in an account pending the appellate process, which could take years to litigate.
Yeah, and Trump doesn't like the optics here, right? He's a rich guy. He's a billionaire, and he's having trouble finding this bond. So there's a lot of concern, apparently, he's expressing to people around him. This is reporting, by the way, from Caitlin Collins over at CNN, who is very well-sourced when it comes to the Trump inner circle. Privately, apparently Trump had been counting on Chubb, the insurance company, to underwrite this. They underwrote his nearly $92 million bond in the E. Jean Carroll judgment. She's the woman who sued him for defamation, accused him of sexual assault in a dressing room in a New York department store back in the 90s. Anyway, Chubb said this time that option is off the table given how large this bond is. Trump's team has been looking for wealthy supporters and been looking at assets that he might have to sell and fast to hit this number. Again, the deadline here is Monday, March 25th. And it could lead the court to take more drastic measures if he's not able to meet this bond. Trump has been lashing out on his social media account, as he is apt to do. Tuesday evening, he took the grievances public, posting on Truth Social that he shouldn't have to put up the money or worry that he's being forced to mortgage or sell off great assets in his description, perhaps at fire sale prices. And if and when I appeal, they would be gone. Does that make any sense? All caps, witch hunt, election interference, exclamation point. So, that's how Trump's feeling about all of this.
Next time, maybe with a little more feeling.
I've spent about a decade trying to read Trump tweets. I hope that you enjoyed that dramatic reading.
And in a different Trump legal case, a Georgia judge on Wednesday greenlit an effort by Trump and his co-defendants to appeal the decision to allow Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis to continue to prosecute the 2020 election subversion case there.
So we have bad news, good news, legal day for Trump. Bad news in terms of that first case we told you about, the civil case. Good news in Georgia, where it now looks pretty clear that he is not going to be facing a criminal trial there anytime soon. Think midway into late 2025, potentially here. Remember, we told you about that case last week, the judge ruling that Fani Willis could stay on the case if the prosecutor that she chose, who she happened to have a romantic relationship with, and there were ethical questions about, if he left, she could stay on the case. Well, Trump's going to appeal that. He wants her off the case. So do his co-defendants. It also has the added benefit of delaying the case further as they adjudicate whether she should stay on the case. So ultimately here, this will go to the Georgia Court of Appeals, probably be appealed again. So this is going to take a while. So as Trump looks at his court calendar here, the federal cases, the classified records case out of Florida, the election interference case out of D.C., the two federal cases, they're not happening anytime soon. They're both delayed for a variety of reasons. The New York case is delayed at least a month because the prosecutors there didn't hand over thousands of documents that the Trump defense should have had access to. That probably still happens this year. But as far as Georgia and the two federal cases, all of them looking like 2025. And by the way, if he is reelected president, both those federal cases go away because he's the new president. And his attorney general could kill those federal cases.
From Reuters, the U.S. government is warning state governors that foreign hackers are carrying out disruptive cyber attacks against water and sewage systems throughout the country. In a letter released this week, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and the head of the EPA warned that, quote, disabling cyber attacks are striking water and wastewater systems throughout the United States. The letter singled out alleged Iranian and Chinese cyber saboteurs. The warning cited a recent case in which hackers accused of acting in concert with Iran's Revolutionary Guards had disabled a controller at a water facility in Pennsylvania. And they also called out a Chinese hacking group dubbed Vault Typhoon, which they said had compromised information technology of multiple critical infrastructure systems, including drinking water in the United States and its territories.
Yeah, remember that the vast majority of what they call critical infrastructure in the U.S. is privately owned. So that's chemical plants, that's nuclear plants, that's, in this case, water facilities. So what the government can do is try to make rules for them, but in many cases, without regulations, because the industry tends to fight regulations because that costs money, they make recommendations. In this case, they're talking to state governors saying, get a hold of your power infrastructure, get a hold of your water infrastructure, because there are bad people out there, bad countries out there, who might want to disrupt your critical lifelines, including safe drinking water. Now, China's embassy in D.C., the Iranian mission at the U.N., not replying to questions, it appears, from the media about any of this. Both countries in the past have denied carrying out any cyber attacks. Frankly, our best defense is the fact that the U.S. can probably do this to them. So the idea is, don't do it to us if you don't want it done to you. But this is a serious issue. Last year's intrusion at a what they call a booster facility, which monitors and regulates water pressure in Pennsylvania, drew particular attention in part because the stricken controller was replaced with a message that said, in all caps, you have been hacked. So clearly the actors there knew what they were doing. They wanted to make a point of showing the vulnerability there. And so this letter to the governors is calling on them to ensure that all the water systems in your state are meeting current cybersecurity practices. And that's a huge issue when we talk about even the basics, right? You know, making sure you have multiple passwords, that your password isn't password one. You know, all the things that you're supposed to be doing for your email, for your financial accounts, are also the things that water treatment, power facilities, et cetera, should be doing.
One of the things that we have discussed offline is that the only silver lining to some of these systems just being so old is that some of them are too old almost to be hacked.
Right. Like some of them are not connected to the internet. Some of them still operate on floppy disk. Remember floppy disk, like the big one? You might have used it for Number Munchers or Oregon Trail back in the day. Speaking to a certain generation there.
As someone who quoted the electric slide in the headlines, yeah, I get it.
Jill, you're picking up what I'm putting down.
And now to an update on the cyber attack on the United Healthcare Group, one of the nation's largest healthcare providers. Its CEO said it is making progress in its recovery from one of the worst cyber attacks on a healthcare system in U.S. history. On February 21st, United Healthcare Group announced a hacking group known as Black Cat breached its system. Its subsidiary, Change Healthcare, was hit hardest. Change Healthcare processes 15 billion healthcare transactions annually and touches about one in every three patient records. These transactions include services that directly affect patient care and pharmacy operations. And the attack, quote, imposed significant consequences on hospitals and the communities they serve.
Yeah. Most of us do not deal with the system, but we benefit from it. We don't have to think about it most of the time, right? This is the back-end system that connects pharmacies, connects doctors, connects insurance companies. And that's what went down here. It was down for nearly a month. Now, the company says it has restored its electronic payments platform in 99% of its pharmacy network. There's some small pharmacies out there that are still impacted. We've heard from some of you. The company has paid more than $2 billion to assist healthcare providers whose finances were impacted here by the attack. The American Hospital Association calling this attack the most significant and consequential incident of its kind against U.S. healthcare in history. The association saying the attack made it challenging for hospitals to provide patient care, complete prescriptions, submit insurance claims, receive payment, basically everything besides the care itself, but paying for that care and communicating with pharmacies. And this is not the first major hack by Black Hat. We told you back in December about their huge hack into MGM on the Las Vegas Strip, which had to shut down operations at that casino, along with a few other properties. You know, if you take away one thing from this story, cyber issues continue to be a major vulnerability across multiple sectors.
From the Wall Street Journal, Cuba is racing to head off protests as shortages spread. Protesters took to the streets of Cuba on Sunday in a rare outburst of social unrest as a fresh wave of blackouts exacerbated tensions on the cash-strapped island. Social media posts showed crowds of people in Santiago de Cuba, the second largest city, chanting "power and food" as police looked on. Most protests are actually illegal in the communist-run nation, but public displays of anger have become more frequent as electricity shortages, inflation, and hunger grip the population. The communist regime on the island has few options to significantly improve living conditions before the oppressively hot summer months, which are usually when most protests happen and when electricity demand soars. These were the first significant protests since 2021, when widespread demonstrations rocked the island and more than 1,000 people were arrested. Since then, increased repression and a spiraling economic downturn sparked an emigration wave of more than 500,000 Cubans to the United States.
Yeah, this gets said again, the original cause of some of the issues we're seeing on our border in these countries across the region. We've talked about Haiti, we've talked about Ecuador, we've talked about Venezuela, and here we are talking about Cuba. One economist telling the Wall Street Journal, the situation is explosive between the blackouts and now the problem with food, power generation on the island, only one-third normal capacity right now. No solution in sight for maybe a year here. The Cuban state-run economy already not in a good situation for decades, but this is the worst crisis now in a number of decades. You know, it lost the Soviet Union back in the early 90s, and then most recently, it was very dependent on Venezuela, but as the Venezuelan economy has collapsed, Cuba has been hit there as well. Cuba used to have a huge sugar export. That has been reduced over the years. It had its smallest harvest in history this year. Just last month, the government said it had no flour. It couldn't guarantee the supply of bread. Jill, when I was in Cuba a couple of years ago, you'd go to the market and listed on the front of the door was how much of food each person could get and what was available. Literally measuring the amount of milk, the amount of cheese, the amount of eggs that you were entitled to. Because again, this is an old school communist run economy here, but now they can't even get the basics to the people, which is why, despite the fact that protests are illegal, people are coming out. And I just remember hearing from people there so frustrated because we had somebody who was driving or and giving us a tour. And I was like, well, how did you get into this? They're like, oh, well, I'm educated as a lawyer. Another person was educated as a doctor, but they found out they were making more money working with tourists than as a doctor or a lawyer on the island because there's specific rules on how much you get paid. So the economy completely broken there. The government model broken, going back to Fidel Castro, then his brother Raul, and now you're in the post-Castro world. But major issues there in Cuba and worth monitoring.
It is interesting because I was in Cuba as well back in 2016, right before then President Obama was set to visit the country. And there was so much optimism and it was palpable. And there were these new private restaurants that were opening and you saw these few small businesses opening as well. And it felt like things were really going to turn around. And of course, that did not happen.
By the way, we should note, interesting timing here. Obama visited Havana March 20th, 2016. So we're exactly 8 years ago this week.
From the BBC, scientists say they have successfully eliminated HIV from infected cells by using Nobel Prize winning CRISPR gene editing technology. Working like scissors, but at the molecular level, it cuts DNA so that bad bits can be removed or inactivated. The hope is to ultimately be able to rid the body entirely of the virus, although much more work is needed to check that it would be safe and effective. Existing HIV medicines can stop the virus, but not eliminate it. The University of Amsterdam, which presented a synopsis of their early findings at a medical conference this week, says that their work remains merely proof of concept and will not become a cure for HIV anytime soon. Another doctor agrees, saying that there will be a lot more development needed before this could have an impact on those living with HIV.
Yeah, we've already gotten to the point when it comes to drugs that they've been able to bring HIV to the point where it's almost undetectable in your body, but of course you still have it. And this is just the latest use here for CRISPR technology. We've been talking about it for several years in the news now in terms of what they can do with gene editing, how far they can go. At the same time, there are concerns with this CRISPR technology, given the way HIV works inside the body, that some of the virus goes into a resting or latent state and certain cells will contain the DNA genetic material of the HIV. So teaching the CRISPR gene technology to figure out what to cut out is going to be a challenge here. And the dormant virus at other points can reawaken. So it may not be a foolproof solution here, but the International AIDS Society says it's still hopeful that whether it's this CRISPR technology or a vaccine, that there will be an AIDS cure at some point.
And finally, Moshe, from ABC News, the French Bulldog has been ranked as the most popular dog in America for the second year in a row, according to the American Kennel Club. As the world's largest registry of purebred dogs, the AKC uses registration statistics to rank the most popular breeds of the past year. Before 2022, the Labrador Retriever had a firm hold on the top spot, keeping an impressive 31-year reign. French Bulldogs surpassed them in 2022 and kept the lead in 2023. The Dachshund is making moves, jumping from the number 9 spot in 2022 to the number 6 spot in 2023. Rottweilers finished number 9 in 2023, moving down from number 7 in 2022. Bulldogs also dropped a spot from number 6 to number 7. The Beagle remains at number 8, and the German Shorthaired Pointer remains at number 10. With no change in rank, I had a German Shorthair Pointer growing up.
Number 10 there, bringing up the rear, Jill. But I mean, there's like dozens and dozens of breeds after that. So the Pointer is still in the top 10. If you're curious about your dog at home and why it might not be in this list, a reminder, they only do pure breeds here. So if you have something that ends in a doodle, that isn't counted here by the American Kennel Club. This is also people who register their dog. So maybe if there's certain breeds where the owners don't tend to be on top of registering there, they might not be there. But, you know, if you look, especially in New York City, Frenchies are everywhere. I can't go anywhere without seeing a French bulldog. And they have become a lightning rod of sort here for controversy, critique. The people who have them love them and they are adorable. At the same time, there are health concerns for the French bulldogs. Their little snouts, the way that they've been bred, can lead to labored breathing, gagging, difficulty with exercise, other issues. It's actually led some countries and cities to ban them. In the Netherlands, they have a ban on breeding certain dogs with muzzles deemed too short. Also, given how coveted these dogs are, there have been pet store heists, violent robberies when it comes to the French bulldogs. You know, just a note there, but I don't mean to rain on your dog parade if you're a Frenchie owner. You got a second year in a row, number one dog in America.
If you remember Lady Gaga, her dog walker was brutally attacked with somebody trying to steal her two French bulldogs.
Yeah, there's a whole black market for these French bulldogs. If you have one, hold it close if you're walking it, especially in a city.
We did say we were going to stay light on this podcast.
We are. We're going to finish because now we're going to On This Day in History before Perfect. Things get too dark. All right, we begin here in the year 1946. Many of us have read about Jackie Robinson, how he broke baseball's color barrier back in 1947. Well, a year earlier in 1946, over in football, the LA Rams signed Kenny Washington, who became the first black player to rejoin the NFL with three others. There had actually been no black players for 13 years, going back to 1933. So NFL has a tough history with this because actually they brought in the first black player back in 1930, but then there was a hiatus on allowing in black athletes in the NFL for more than a decade due to controversy in certain parts of segregated America. Then on this day in 46, they start to let African-Americans play again. All right, fast forward to the 1960s here. 61 years ago today, Alcatraz, the notorious prison that held Al Capone and others, was closed on this day. Jill, have you ever been out there in the Bay Area for a tour of Alcatraz?
I have. I've done a tour, and it's incredible with all of the fog surrounding it, and to think that people escaped from there.
I know, into the waters and the cold waters of the Bay. We're going to stay in California here for this next story. Just a year before that, actually, the year before Alcatraz closed in 62, down in Downey, California, the first Taco Bell opened. So, Jill, a quick check here. I don't see Taco Bell offering anything for free for their birthday, but it appears they have launched what they call the new Cantina Chicken menu for the next couple of weeks. So I don't know if there's any Taco Bell fans out there. This is not a paid ad, by the way.
No, but if they want to pay us for it, all good.
All right, a couple of more items. On this day in 06, the first tweet was sent out by Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey. It read simply, "Just setting up my Twitter," but he actually spelled it T-W-T-T-R, leaving out the vowels there. Just a few years later, Elon Musk would buy it up and rename it X. But for us, it'll always be Twitter.
I was going to ask you that. Have you grown accustomed at all to X?
No, and I never will. All right, let's end here with music. On this day 37 years ago, U2 released one of their biggest hits, With or Without You. And on this day 24 years ago, we said hello to Bye Bye Bye, NSYNC releasing their third studio album, No Strings Attached. 24 years ago today, March 21st, 2000, It's Gonna Be Me, Bye Bye Bye. They would make just one more album after that, and then Justin would leave and go independent. Though Jill, as we told folks on the pod last week, they reunited ever so briefly for his newest album.
It's true. And we're also about 6 weeks from It's Gonna Be May.
Yes. Another way that album lives on every May 1st, or I should say actually the last week of April when the memes start to appear.
All right, everyone, it's time to go bye, bye, bye. Thank you for listening to the Mo News Podcast. If you like what you hear, share this with your friends. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Review us in the App Store and really appreciate everyone who followed our newest podcast, the Mo News Interview, because it propelled us pretty high in the charts.
Yes, as of late on Wednesday, we're neck and neck with Ted Cruz, Rachel Maddow, and Don Lemon up there in the news charts. So keep following the show, downloading it over in the, especially if you listen to us on Apple for Mo News, The Interview. And also, Jill is starting a side business as a bar mitzvah DJ between Electric Slide and Bye Bye Bye. If you like her rendition, if you like that mix, hit her up. She's available Saturday afternoons.
I turn into a pumpkin by 9 p.m. though, so we just got to wrap up by then.
No evening occasion. She will only do daytime appearance.
All right, everyone. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.